Well, bonjour. You'll see what I mean. Welcome to Spectrum West, everybody. I'm Al Ross. It's March, middle of March, March Madness. Ooh. Today on the program, we have Randy Sabine, jazz violin and multi-instrumentalist and vocalist. He's got a new CD. We'll hear parts of that, too. Jim Oliver brings us news of a stage production of To Kill a Mockingbird coming to Barron. We'll look back at the Ken Anderson years of UW-Eau Claire basketball through the eyes of retired sports info director Tim Peterman. He has a multimedia presentation about it all. And what do you say we shove off this culture cruise with this? Mary Tyler Moore. I think her name was Mary Richards in the TV program. Well, she has nothing on Delana Nelson. Both decided on an adventure. Both adventures involve Minneapolis. Mary made it there. Delana hasn't yet. Delana's story ends up in Aix-en-Provence, a beautiful city full of beautiful people in the south of France. After leaving Eau Claire, she's made the most of the experience. She helps other women withstand what she had to endure when setting out solo. It's called Travel Solo Boot Camp. And we shared an international phone call just the other day. I read the quote, and I'll read it here. No other country loves women more than France. Femininity rules here. It's in the cuisine, the wine, stylish fashions, and, of course, the romance of France. So let's begin by setting the stage and find out how you, as an officer in this feminine special forces unit, which I like to call it, you earned your stars beginning 6 years ago. Give us a brief thumbnail of how this all started for you.
Okay, well, I was living in Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
My house was empty. I was in an empty nest. I knew it was time to probably move to the big city, and so I was planning on moving to Minneapolis. I was close to 50, and I knew that once I quit the job I had there and moved to a new job, at that age, I'd probably better think about staying with that job until the end of my working career. I've always had a little bit of wanderlust, and I thought, if I don't do what I've always wanted to do right this very minute, I probably won't get a chance until I'm older, and I want to do it now.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that I would take a year, and France was just, it just was. There wasn't really any question. I couldn't tell you why. I didn't speak French. I don't have ancestors from France or anything like that. I had been to France before. I'd been there once when I was in college very briefly, and I had been there, I think it was in 2001, with my mom and my sister. We did an Italy-France trip.
Okay.
So I prepared for a year. I decided to sell my house, which I did really quickly, too quickly, as a matter of fact, and then I sold my belongings and kept enough so that I could have an apartment when I got back, put it in storage, and took off.
Literally took off.
I literally took off. I mean, there's preparation involved in moving to another country, and, you know, you have to get a visa, and you have to decide where you're going to live, and,
yeah,
and all those sorts of things. But so it wasn't just, you know, a snap of the finger sort of thing. But I flew to France a year after the day I decided I was going to do it.
You stepped off the plane in France. Then what?
I couldn't get out of the airport because I didn't speak French. And I had to call somebody, and I couldn't even use the phone because I couldn't understand what they were saying to me on the phone. So I found a very kind Canadian who spoke two languages and who helped me make the phone call I needed to make to get my ride, to get me to my rented apartment and all that. In fact, I arrived in France 2 days after a huge snowstorm, the biggest snowstorm in 40 years. And I was stuck in Amsterdam for 2 days, and we got a foot of snow in the Mediterranean. So Rome was closed. I mean, all of the coast of Italy was closed. Marseille was closed. So I came into town kind of shuffling through, not, we wouldn't call them snowbanks, not from where we're from, but the muck. I thought, what have I done? I was coming to the south of France, and I landed in snow without my baggage because it all got lost, and I had no way to figure out how to find it.
You had some things set up. I mean, you knew where you were going, and you had, what did you have, a contact for a place to live? What happened?
Using, Google Translation, I found, to do it, I found somebody that rented an apartment here, you know, kind of a seasonal apartment for tourists. So I rented it for a month. So I knew I had a place to stay when I got here, a place to put my bags down. And I ended up, in fact, staying there 5 or 6 months. She liked me, and she reduced my rent. But, yeah, I did have a place to land. It seemed almost like a walk-in closet to me, except it had a beautiful terrace, a little tiny terrace. If I laid out in the sun, my feet were inside. But it was wonderful, you know, just to be someplace that I'd always wanted to be, and it was my own little apartment, and I could hear somebody singing opera somewhere nearby, and I just thought, oh, my gosh, this is so cool.
My head is imagining a Mary Tyler Moore moment with you on the corner, throwing your hat up in the air. And...
Yeah, it was kind of like that, except, you know, I was I was wearing boots that were wet and had been wet for 7 days, so probably wasn't quite the Mary Tyler Moore moment, but I felt that way inside.
So on to the entrepreneurship. You must have met other women needing support and guidance during their own adventures, and it blossomed. Is that the way it happened?
What happened was I started to write a blog.
Okay.
I had thought that I might want to write a book or something because what I was doing was fun. And so it was suggested to me by somebody that I start a blog. So I started a blog and wrote on a regular basis. And through that blog, of course, you meet a lot of people. People contact you. People write you. They're always saying to me, I'm living vicariously through you. I wish I had the courage to do what you're doing.
Uh-huh.
Those kinds of remarks. Kind of took it all with a grain of salt because I didn't feel particularly courageous. And then one day, a friend of mine that I had met, another American who had lived here for about 12 years, she was actually the one that launched this idea. When she first told me about it, I said, that doesn't make any sense to help people learn to travel. And then I realized the next day, I called her back and I said, you know what? Two of my very best friends in the world are in that exact same situation. They want to travel. They've traveled. But they've never done it alone, and they're in a situation in their lives where if they don't travel alone, they're not going to travel. But they're almost paralyzed by the what ifs and how and what if this happened and I don't know how to do that, you know, that sort of thing. And they're well-educated, bright women, but this is a reality. And I realized that the next day. This is so real. This is touches me personally several times. So from there, we just kept working with the idea.
We're talking long distance with Delana Nelson, and the subject is Travel Solo Boot Camp. It's something that she and a partner came up with and are having fun with in France. Tell us what trainees go through. Someone contacts you. What happens?
We start out with, we have sessions. They're a week-long session. I get a little bit of information about them, what their worries are, what kinds of things they like to do. And then before their session starts, they start getting information from us. There might be some language they need to learn, how to pack. Not just how to pack, because there's plenty of information on that. For instance, one of the things about traveling solo is you don't necessarily want to look like a tourist. I never mind looking like a tourist, but the less you look like one, the less you might get into a situation that you hear about.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, being targeted by whomever for whatever. So we help them figure out how to pack and not wearing their zip-off pants and their tennis shoes. How can that be done? We will send them information about the country, about the kind of the etiquette of the country. We also have one day that's their day to go to do something like a painting class or a cooking class. And we set that up, what it is they want to do, because each one of them has to be set up privately.
All this preliminary information you're giving me, that happens before they travel? This is all online or via email?
Before they even come here.
Okay.
Uh-huh. It will all be readdressed once they get here. For instance, the language. We'll send them some vocabulary or phrases that they need to learn. But, of course, something written is not going to be the same as actually saying it.
Sure.
The accent is different, and it's hard to understand. So when they get here, one of our evenings where we have an apéro together, we have a French woman come in, and we practice. Practicing language with a glass of wine and some olives and some great cheese is, you know, really a great class.
Oh, so, yeah.
And another night while we're having an apéro or dinner together, we'll have somebody come in and talk about etiquette and how things are different in France, how you behave in a social situation that might be different in France than it is elsewhere. Another night we will go to the market as one of their assignments. They're sent out of town. They have to take some public transportation to go out of town and buy some ingredients for dinner, and then they all come back. And that evening we will cook dinner with somebody who will come in and help us learn some French cooking. So basically what we do is we send them out, push them out of the nest a little bit each day. They get their assignments. And then we bring them back to the nest to talk about it and to talk about how we could do it better, because the next day they're going to get pushed a little farther.
Sure. You gave them preliminary information through the wonders of technology, which a business mm-hmm. like yours really has got to be thankful for, things like the internet and email.
There's no other way.
How big of classes do you do? I mean, do you say you're all coming here at the same time?
They come at the same time, but there's no more than 8 at a time.
Okay. That's good to know.
They'll come at the same time. We don't want them to come as a group, in fact. We're learning to travel solo, so we want them to stay in their own apartment while they're here, and we help them find an apartment. I'm not going to make their travel arrangements for them, but I will tell them which routes, which airports I think are the easiest to do and the easiest to negotiate.
Makes a lot of sense.
When they arrive, we will pick them up from the airport so they haven't landed like I did with mm-hmm. a telephone card and no capabilities of getting out of there. But during that week, we're going to teach them how they can do that so that the next time they land in an airport, they know how to get out of there.
Have any women done what you did? They showed up and they haven't left?
Not from my group, but there are a lot of women like me here. I think that's why we say in the website that France is a place for women. It's very odd that there's so many of us here. It's not strange to find a single woman living here on her own who just kind of blew the coop. Of course, a lot of people will say, well, what are you running away from? And none of us look at it that way. We sort of like, we were running to something, you know, something we wanted to do, something that mattered to us.
That's great. And what you teach them pertains to, at least from the beginning, how to make their way to and through France, but you have enough general information that from then on, if they decide to visit any other country, a lot of the basics have been covered.
We're a boot camp that just happens to be in France, and how cool is that? On the other hand, what I want them to be able to, you know, see a great deal to go to New York City. You know, there's just this great deal. There's a hotel and a plane, and there's nobody around that can go with them, and they can say, you know what, I'm taking the deal. I'm going to New York City because I feel confident that I can make my way around, that I can have a meal by myself and enjoy myself. I can take public transportation. I know that I can do this. It doesn't even matter if they go to another country. What matters is they can live their life the way they want to do it without that little fear that's always picking at the back of their brain. That's what I want.
I wanted this to be an hors d'oeuvre. I wanted people to have their appetites whetted and then say, I've got to find out more about this. So how do they do that?
Well, they can go to our website, which is www.travel-solo-bootcamp.com.
Mm-hmm.
They can read about what we do and see when we have sessions. The contact information is there. They can write to me and find out more, tell me a little bit more about themselves, and I can certainly call somebody. That is mm-hmm. absolutely no problem. So if somebody wants me to call them, I'm happy to do that.
Wonderful. Delana Nelson. Hey, you know, I'm happy for you because I can tell that you're happy for yourself.
I am. I am. There are some days as I'm walking down my little street coming back from the market, even after 6 years, I really do pinch myself sometimes and say, I can't believe I live here.
Thanks for being with us on Spectrum West.
Thank you.
And again, in case you want to visit, the website is www.travel-solo-bootcamp.com. Ah, the south of France. There are worse places to get an education. This is Spectrum West. Thanks so much for being with us. Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Cave Artist, a prehistoric musical comedy, will play through Sunday at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The Barron Spotlighters will present Kill a Mockingbird, Friday through Sunday, at the Barron Area Community Center. And Then They Came for Me, Remembering the World of Anne Frank, will play March 25th to the 27th and the 29th at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. The Northern Star Theater in Rice Lake will stage The Pirates of Penzance, March 25th to the 29th. The musical Little Women will be staged by the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild through Sunday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will stage Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing Friday and Saturday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. Breaking Up is Hard to Do will play Friday and Saturday at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show will run through May 30th. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver. Thank you, sir. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Volume 1 and the Local Store, featuring locally inspired gifts, books, music, apparel, and art. Inside the historic building at 205 North Dewey Street in downtown Eau Claire or online at volume1.org/store. Well, happy 330th birthday to Johann Sebastian Bach. It's Saturday. Here's Maestro Yasuda of the Chippewa Valley Symphony with a special tribute.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to Johann. Happy birthday to you.
Well, sorry, the music didn't go along with it. Starting immediately after graduation from UW-Eau Claire back in the early 70s until his retirement, Tim Peterman oversaw the promotion and support of Blue Gold Athletics. As sports information director, he was on the sidelines for many memorable moments and seasons, and much of that time he was able to witness and document the 27-year career of Ken Anderson as head basketball coach. There was more than enough accomplishment to supply Peterman the material to put together a presentation dubbed The Ken Anderson Years, an era for the ages, a multimedia presentation that tells the story of this amazingly satisfying chapter in Blue Gold sports history. This week, he made a presentation as part of the Chancellor's Centennial History Series, and he stopped by the studio to share the anthology story with us. Well, 1967, you arrived at UW-Eau Claire. Turned out to be the place of your career.
It did. Was very fortunate that things just fell into place after I got here, with being able to get a journalism degree and then turn that into a position as sports information director for 40 years.
When did you know that it might turn out to be the place of your career?
Probably my junior year, maybe the start of my senior year, when I went to the athletic director and said, you know, I really don't need to have a degree to do what I'm doing. I'm doing fine right now, working 40 hours a week doing this sports information stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That was Jim Rice. He said, you get your degree. And then when I got the degree, they created the position for me. And everything just fell into place, and I just moved forward from there.
So up to that point, they did not have a...
We did not have a sports information office. It was all handled through the News Bureau prior to that time.
Talk about the job of sports information director and maybe how it changed over the years of your tenure.
Yes, it has significantly changed. When I came in, primarily what it was at the time was stats keeping.
Mm-hmm.
I did stats keeping my first year for football, basketball, and baseball. After that, it turned into developing small media guides where we had little sketches about the players that were on these various teams. And then by my junior year, I was writing press releases. One of the big changes that's occurred over the years is when I figured stats, we'd have to always type those up by hand, but we also had to figure them by hand or with a slide rule. And now if I say that to somebody, they have no idea what a slide rule is. Went from slide rules to calculators,
yep.
And now we have the computers. And I was used to typing everything up. If you made mistakes, you started over, if you were working on a ditto, you used a little razor blade and corrected it and typed over it and tried to make it look pretty good. Then we had self-correcting typewriters and then computers where if you made a mistake, you could easily fix it. So it's changed over the years. Now it's such an instantaneous position. Everybody wants it right now. You have to have everything out on the web right away. I had a little more time to get things prepared and to do them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it took a little longer, but that's the big change in sports information. But we're still providing information to the media for covering Blue Gold sports or sports in general.
One of the paragraphs in the biographical dispatch that you sent was headlined, "The Zorn Mystique." But, you know, in essence, I think there was a Ken Anderson aura, and it started almost immediately after he arrived on campus, and it turned out that this was his place of destiny as well.
That's right. It did not take him long to establish himself here. That's the interesting thing. The university did not have a successful basketball team since the mid-50s. So about 11 years they went without a lot of success in basketball. He came in the first year and he had more wins with an all-freshman team. So it started right away. And then after a first year of going 14-8 with a lot of freshman players, that team went to 24 wins, then 26, and then 29 just that quickly. And so when you have success after not having it for a long time, the people jump on board that bandwagon, and it just took off from there. You know, he made Zorn his stomping ground, and he made sure he played plenty of home games, and he won nearly 90% of them at home. So that leads to a pretty good season record all the time.
What a record. 387-44. That's... Wow. We're smack dab in the middle of March Madness, thus it's right that we're talking with Tim Peterman. He's retired sports information director, UW-Eau Claire. He has a presentation called The Ken Anderson Years, An Era for the Ages, and he is presenting it this week. By the time we hear this, it will already have happened, but I have a feeling that this presentation is close to Tim's heart, and he'd be willing to present it anywhere. He's presenting it as part of the Chancellor's Centennial History Series. Ken was also very instrumental in starting what is now a staple in development of young athletes, the sports camp.
Yes, he established the first resident basketball camp in the state of Wisconsin while he was still at Wausau East High School, and he developed that up at Minocqua. And then when he came to Eau Claire in 1968, he brought the camp with him. To me, that camp was so significant in the ability for him to recruit in the state of Wisconsin. Two reasons. It got him in contact with kids as they were growing up so he could see which kids were developing and could potentially play for them. He had coaches from high schools throughout the state that worked the camp for him, so he had a network of coaches. And then thirdly, he got the kids on the UW-Eau Claire campus, which we always have called Wisconsin's most beautiful campus. So if they were on the campus and saw the campus, had connection with the coach, there were high school coaches. I mean, he had a network of people and could be in contact with the best players in the state.
During Ken's tenure, was UW-Eau Claire known for a certain style of play? Did he have a moniker? Was it tenacious defense?
It was a tenacious defense, and he had a strong rebounding emphasis. Okay. He brought in strong, big guys. During his time here, we had 3 7-footers play for us. I looked it up, but we had 41 players that were 6'7 or taller. And not only were they that big, but they were good talent because about 26 of them made all-conference teams or were conference players of the year. But defensively, we led the NEI about 4 times during his time here in defensive average, and typically we were ranked among the top 10 teams in the NEI in defense. So defense was a key component for his success, and because defense tends to be more consistent than offense, that I'm sure contributed to some of the success that he had.
Interesting that both Ken and Dick Bennett were both small-town Wisconsin kids.
Yes, they were.
I didn't realize that Ken was from...
He was from Abbotsford.
Abbotsford.
And, of course, Dick was from Clintonville.
Yep. And I got to know Ken in the 90s just after moving to Eau Claire, and kind of like Bull Ryan is basking in a sports spa now, Ken had the same kind of situation during his UW-Eau Claire tenure. In-state ball players, he's good at getting them. We talked about the home court winning percentage. And I noted that Bo had the UW-Platteville court named after him in 2007. It took us 5 years later to name it after Ken, didn't it?
It took a little longer to get it done, but it definitely was deserving of Ken's time here and what he did. There was an article by Ron Buckley of the Leader Telegram at the time the court was named, and he pointed out how Ken helped put UW-Eau Claire and the city of Eau Claire on the national map. I think people knew in the state where Eau Claire was. Maybe some down in Milwaukee and Madison didn't, but he certainly brought that to the fore in the state, but also on a national level. One of the things that he did with his schedule every year was he brought in teams from throughout the country. Our Holiday Classic developed into a significant tournament throughout the country because of the quality of teams that he brought in. He wanted to get his teams ready for conference play. You only had a couple games before the tournament and most of your schedule afterwards. He had some great great teams come into Zorn Arena. And so the name Eau Claire, by winning that as often as he did, it became well known throughout the country. 25 years ago, on the 19th of March, we played in the national championship game in Kansas City with Clark Kellogg and Tim Brando calling a live play-by-play on ESPN.
Wow.
I mean, that certainly gave us national attention. Not that we hadn't gotten it prior to that time. I mean, in 1981, he went down to Iowa City and played the University of Iowa when they were ranked among the top 25 teams in the country, and we didn't embarrass ourselves. One of the things we had going in NAI District 14 is we used a Dunkel rating system to rank our teams to determine postseason playoffs. In 1989-90, we had a rating that ranked us 99th out of 1,200 schools in the country at all levels. I mean, so he had developed to a high level, comparable to a lot of Division I programs with no scholarships.
Tim Peterman with us, retired sports information director from UW-Eau Claire. It's March Madness. We're talking hoops. I'm a basketball purist. And there are some things that have left the game, many ways of playing the game that have changed. The state of basketball, the media moneymaker is very good. It's a lot of fun to watch. But as a purist, it has evolved. I mean, it's a contact sport now. How do you feel about the state of basketball?
I agree. And there were even some changes that I'm noting in my presentation that affected what Ken Anderson was able to do here. In 1968, when he came at the NCAA Division I level, freshmen could not play. If you'll remember, Lou Alcindor was on the freshman team that beat the varsity when they were defending national champs at UCLA because freshmen could not play. That allowed Coach Anderson to get some of the best players in the state to come to Eau Claire because they could have a four-year career. I am showing some clips from the 1972 and the 1990 championship games. I had forgotten that in 1972, when you fouled right away in the game, the opponent shot a free throw, just one, until you got to the bonus. But that free throw rule has changed.
Yeah.
In 1968 to 72, we had some outstanding players. They could not dunk. Going on with some of the other rules, the three-point rule didn't come into play until 1985 or 86, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. So you had some guys like Frank Shady who shot some long shots that only counted as
yes.
two.
Yeah.
What would have happened
yeah.
with those players? How many points would they have scored?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the team 71-72, that era, they averaged 86 points a game without
the
three-point shot.
Wow. This is the kind of presentation I think a lot of people would like to see. What if somebody's listening and they say, oh, I got to call Tim and have him come and put this on for our club?
I would do it. Okay. I've told somebody else that. I've already done it once as a warm-up for this presentation. I would certainly be willing to come and do this for anyone that could get a group together.
Okay.
I could also do a separate one where we show the entire 1990 championship game or the 1972 game. The 1990 game has the audio of ESPN with it. The 1972 game I'd have to narrate, but I know all those guys, so that wouldn't be hard either.
Hey, Tim, congratulations on a great career. I mean, some sports information directors don't have much to do or write about during their career. We were one of the lucky guys.
I was very lucky. I think I was very fortunate, and a lot of my success was because I was dealing with Ken Anderson's program, and there was a lot of media attention, so I had a chance to work with a lot of media, not only throughout the state, but throughout the country.
And though our focus today has been on basketball, UW-Eau Claire is well known for lots of other sports throughout your career.
What a great week we had this week. With our men's track team winning its first national title in the NCAA Division III indoors. So, yes, we have. We've won a lot of individual and team national championships, had a lot to write about.
Yes, sir, quite a legacy. And if your group would like Tim to share his presentation, The Ken Anderson Years and Era for the Ages, you can contact him at petermta@uwec.edu. That's Peter, PETERMTA at uwec.edu. Or you can call him at 836-5878. 836-5878. You can leave a number and you'll get a return call. Spectrum West, having a good time. Middle of March. A classic set over 50 years ago in a small town in the South comes to a small town in the North. Here's Jim Oliver.
The season's final production by the Barron Spotlighters is To Kill a Mockingbird, a classic drama that deals with the state of race relations in the 1950s. The show will run Friday through Sunday and next Friday through Sunday at the Barron Area Community Center. Joining us to talk about the show is its director, Jody Swanson. Welcome back to Spectrum West.
Well, thank you, Jim.
Well, To Kill a Mockingbird is a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel written by Harper Lee in 1960. It was followed by a movie starring Gregory Peck in 1962, which won 3 Academy Awards and is considered one of the greatest films ever made. And the play came along in 1990. So tell us about the story and then kind of give an assessment of how the play stacks up against the book and the movie.
The play that we're doing is definitely true. It has to cut out a lot. But the story is of a small town, Macon, Alabama, that has a black man who's on trial for his life being accused of raping a white woman. And the person who is defending him is Atticus Finch. And To Kill a Mockingbird is kind of told through the story of his 10-year-old daughter with the nickname of Scout. In the story, you see all the prejudices against blacks and whites against their own neighbors, you know, whites against whites.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very interesting thing that a lot of people don't pick up on right away when they're reading the book or you see the movie. You have to draw attention to it. In the movie, they have different things to point out about Boo Radley. And the play, I think, was just beautifully written. And they have the neighbors. One is pro-equality, and one is, this is the way things always have been.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting how the play can actually bring a whole town together with only a few characters.
Hmm. So there's certainly racial turmoil still going on around the country.
Yes.
But there's a significant difference between the segregated South of the 1950s and today. Is the story still relevant?
I do think the story is still relevant. But yes, I mean, there are differences of what we think. Growing up, my kids, I made sure they were not racist, which sounds funny, but it's an actual process. It's a thinking process. You know what? My kids have more culture with theater, and they've been all over the world, and they've seen things differently than some of the small-town mentality thoughts that are out there. And so is it relevant? I think it is. In the last couple of years, how many different nationwide, the shooting of gang members or not gang members, and were they a gang, and the trials, the following of all these decisions, and the cops, and I think it absolutely is still a relevant issue. I think there's still some underlying hatred. You hear it with relevance to the presidency. I see, you know, those posters on the side of the road people make, you know, black men not shouldn't be in office. We shouldn't have those kinds of thoughts, but we do. As a nation, there are members who still feel that way. And I think people look at the skin color versus other attributes. And I just have tried for many years to get this show up on stage around small town northern Wisconsin. And it is hard to try and find people of ethnic who are interested in theater. And I am blessed with the cast I have because I had a man who walked in, he goes, I want to be in this play. Hmm. I can't believe someone is doing this. I can't believe it. I'm so excited.
Hmm.
I actually had to look around for somebody to play the man who was falsely accused of rape.
Hmm.
Finally, I found a guy who said, you know what? Yeah, this is a good story. It does need to be told.
Yeah. So who are the principal actors?
Wow. The play is written so that the children are the leads.
Uh-huh.
Which is very, very interesting. My scout is Laurel Wagner, and she is just phenomenal. Been involved in different theaters, stuff, and dance. Usually she's in musicals, so a drama is a new avenue for her. Her dance partner is Benedict, we call him Ben, on Carlo, and he is just phenomenal playing her brother, Jem Finch. And then we have Christopher Jenke, who plays the young man who's traveling, named Dill. He does a great job. He adds a different dynamic to the whole production, just because Dill is somebody not from this area.
And so their dynamics on stage, as a director, I had my assistant director and I, we pulled a couple of different rehearsals and built their dynamics first so that, one, they would have confidence in this production because it's so much different than a musical, and then having them work with each other so that they would know, you know, the quirks and what we're looking for, what things that they can bring forward. And they're blessed to have Brandon Brown play Atticus Finch, who is their father, the lawyer who defends Tom Robinson, who is played by Will Buckner. He does a phenomenal job as a man who's never done theater before in learning how to be a man in that time frame. Some of the exercises I've had him do to play Tom, and he just keeps saying, "That's not fair. That's not fair." And I'm like, "It absolutely isn't fair." And I told him once, Tom, and he turns and looks at me because I call him by their character names. I said, "Do you trust this man? Do you trust Atticus to give you every shot? Do you trust him as a man?" He goes, "I have to. He's holding my life in his hands."
Hmm.
And I want that experience for my audience. I want my audience to feel they are back there and how relevant some of these thoughts are still today. Other actors I have on my stage, like I said, Brandon Brown, great Atticus Finch. My Boo Radley is a gentleman named Derek Rogers. He is one of our great tech guys on the Baron Spotlighters team. He does a great job. He plays a couple roles. I have John Harden, who is an old name with Baron Spotlighters, but he brings such a presence to the stage as Walter Cunningham, who helps lead the mob. And then Stephen Mitchell plays Bob Yule, the father of the girl who supposedly was raped.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my most proudest young actors is Violet Hoff. She plays Mayella Violet Yule, the one who is supposedly the victim of this rape.
Mm-hmm. She is Jody Swanson, director of the Baron Spotlighters production of To Kill a Mockingbird. Well, talk a little bit about your experience in theater.
I have a bachelor's degree in theater arts with directing, design, and performance from Boise State University. I am blessed to call Baron Spotlighters my home for the last seven and a half years. I've done a lot of different shows out in Boise, out in New Mexico, and of course here in the Race Lake Baron area. I love different kinds of theaters, between the musicals and the dramas and the farces and being all part of comedy. So I have a lot of experience under my belt as a director, a designer, and an actress on the stage. I've been out in Red Barn with a friend of mine. So somebody asked me recently, how many shows have you directed? I'm thinking I'm closer to 30.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of potential ulcers there, I would think.
Yeah, nightmares, migraines, all that.
Right. Well, in addition to your theater habits, you also write books.
I do, Jim. I write some science fiction based on some weird dreams that I've had, and a friend of mine jokingly said, you should turn that into a book. Mm. And a English professor one day said, "The final, you guys get to write a children's book," and I was all excited, "or a book of poetry," I'm thinking children's book, "or the first three novels of a chapter," and I'm thinking children's book.
Hmm.
But my friend said, "Nope, you really need to write that stuff down. You need to write down your dreams and make it happen." And my dreams were kind of weird and fantastical in a very realistic way, I guess. I think Jason Bourne meets The Matrix, and I started writing the first book way before there was a Jason Bourne and way before there was a Matrix.
Oh, gee.
Yeah.
Well, we've been visiting with Jody Swanson, who is director of the Baron Spotlighters production of To Kill a Mockingbird. The show runs Friday through Sunday and the following Friday through Sunday at the Baron Area Community Center. For ticket information, you can call the Spotlighters office at 715-537-9212. Or send an email to tickets@baronspotlighters.org. Or you can do like I did and Google Baron Spotlighters, and you can find all of that information there. Jody Swanson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jim. Pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Oliver. Spectrum West continues here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And you know, support for WPR comes from the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. Sinatra and Company music from the Rat Pack era, featuring Colleen Ray, Debbie O'Keefe, and Tim Patrick with the Blue Eyes Band. March 28th, 7:30. Details at MabelTainter.org. Spectrum Memo at the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory, Saturday evening, the annual evening of stories, poems, and music to celebrate St. Patty's Day, 7:30. The website's northernlakecenter.org. Friday night, Phil Vassar comes to the State Theater in Eau Claire. The Eau Claire Regional Arts Center, 7:30. EauClaireArts.com is the website. The phone is 832-ARTS. At the Phipps Center in Hudson, Friday and Saturday, the Phipps Dance Company celebrates its 10th season with showcase performances Friday, 7:30 p.m., Saturday, 2 p.m. There's watercolor workshops in March and April. There are three new exhibits in the galleries. Go online at thephipps.org. Hey, congratulations to the Student Voice and WRFW, the newspaper and the campus radio station at UW River Falls. They were award winners from the Wisconsin Newspaper Association Foundation and the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. That's the first track on his latest CD called The Soul of a Man. Jazz fiddle guy Randy Sabine has always been a busy musician, writing and teaching at McNally Smith in St. Paul, where students learn the aspects of a career in music and music production. He also loves performing. He loves it a lot. And West Wisconsin is fortunate to have him in our midst. Come next Thursday, March 26th, Randy performs at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls as part of the Sue Orfield Show, a community TV offering. It's been a while since we last conversed, so we rang him up at his office at school to talk about life, his new CD, and more. Your bio says that you wanted to play drums, which I found interesting, but in the fourth grade, you were persuaded to play the violin. At age 19, you discovered your niche, then on to Berkeley and Boston. People like Grappelli instituted the concept and term jazz violin. I'm wondering, after reading all that stuff, is the idiom alternative strings just another way of saying jazz violin, or is there more to it than that?
Well, if you say, you know, jazz, then you eliminate quite a few other styles of music that can be played on the violin and that I play on the violin. For example, it would kind of rule out fiddle, folk music. It might rule out rock and roll and, you know, experimental music. So basically, you know, I use the word jazz because it's a big world, mm-hmm. and it's improvisational music, and it really separates you from classical music. But there's so much more that a violin can do. Just to be a jazz violinist is not necessarily accurate. So mm-hmm. try to come up with some terms that are more broad, I guess.
I had an interesting conversation last week with Jake Armerding. He's a fiddle player and lives in Minneapolis. We were talking about the versatility, as you just mentioned, of the violin. I mean, he puts the violin into positions in tunes that you wouldn't expect. In other words, you're listening to a song and you expect a good guitar solo to come up, and he'll do the solo on the violin, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
You do that kind of stuff as well?
Yeah, I get a lot of sounds out of the violin. I don't use a lot of special effects. I'm pretty much a straight acoustic player, but there's lots of sounds I can emulate on the violin. For example, I can sound just like Jimi Hendrix getting feedback on his electric guitar entirely acoustically. So it's a very colorful instrument. And there's lots of, you know, untapped sounds that aren't, you know, you don't learn traditionally when you start classical violin in fourth grade.
So you can play the national anthem just like Jimmy did?
Well, I could probably do a good imitation of it. And I can set my violin on fire when I'm done, too.
Oh, yeah, why not? Sure. You know, a lot of people, their pride and joy is playing like a Stradivarius from the 1700s. You have kind of a contemporary violin that you love.
Yeah, I have a violin that's built by a living maker, Ray Melanson, out in Boston. And he continues to build instruments, and it's not a priceless Stradivarius. There's a lot of contemporary makers in the world these days, and they're making excellent sounding instruments, and, you know, they're affordable and they're replaceable. You know, if this violin of mine was stolen or damaged or destroyed or whatever, and you just call the guy up and he probably has one on his shelf that's even better than the one I have, and it's concept of, yo, got to have an old Strad that sounds good, it's long gone.
You, more than many people with whom I've spoken, appear to be on a musical journey where there doesn't seem to be any destination. As they say, the joy is in the journey. You collaborate and you experiment and investigate and you attempt things. John Lennon was well known for doing that. Is that what's in the heart of a true musician, always believing there's more to discover?
Well, it starts from just listening to a lot of music. I like a wide range of music, and I think most creative, artistic people, whether they're musicians or you know, graphic artists or whatever, you know, you get bored with doing one thing. Mm-hmm. And I like to do a lot of different things, and I don't even like, you know, being pigeonholed necessarily as a violin player, because I play guitar and piano, and I write my own songs, I write instrumentals, I write songs with lyrics, and I like to keep myself interested in things, and, mm-hmm. and by nature, you follow a path, and you get bored, and something else calls your attention, and then you do that, and oh, here's a great idea, and then you meet somebody who's doing something cool, and you want to do it together. It's mm-hmm. just, it's kind of hard to plan that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You have to kind of wait to see what's around the corner.
Is that the kind of stuff you try to instill in students? I mean, can desire be taught?
I could lead by example. Certainly can show sure. the process, and it is an exploration. When I have my students in my classes and lessons here at McNally Smith College of Music, it isn't just, okay, here's your assignment, practice this, come back next week, and if you didn't practice, if you're not good enough, then I'll give you a lecture, and you know, you have to come back next week to perfect this piece. It's a lifestyle of, you know, how to explore music, and part of that, it involves, you know, some technique for sure, and mm-hmm. opening up a book and doing an exercise. But another part of just a musician's daily regime is to step away from the music, explore, try some new sounds, listen to this record. You know, oh, you like this? Well, you should go check out this person. So mm-hmm. it's definitely not just practice this, learn this piece, but it's what do you do as a musician, as a creative person? What do you do all day long?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a lifestyle.
Enjoying a phone conversation with Randy Sabin, jazz violinist. He's coming to the Heidi Center Thursday, the 26th, 7:30. That's in Chippewa Falls, of course. Let's talk, Randy, about CD number 11. It's called Soul of a Man. You're right. On the cover, standing in water with a violin in your left hand, fly rod in your right. And you're dressed every inch like a fly fisherman. Does that photo illustrate the soul of Randy Sabin, fiddling and fishing?
Well, I guess that was kind of the point. That mm-hmm. lake is right in the Minneapolis area. It's Lake Hiawatha. It's like in the middle of nowhere, but my car is parked right behind there. It was a posed picture before the record came out, and then things develop. I'm in the studio, and I'm recording a bunch of tunes, and we're recording this Blind Willie Johnson tune, Soul of a Man, and we ended up with all this material, and what should I call the record, and what should I put on the cover, and it was like those things came together, and yeah, I think you could probably, that'd be a safe conclusion to come to.
The CD features a bunch of fellow educators.
I recorded it here in the studios with my fellow colleagues. A couple special guests, Pat Donahue mm-hmm. from the Prairie Home Companion, sang one of my songs. A couple other guest vocalists, Prudence Johnson, sings a couple tunes with me.
Any surprises on the CD? Any eyebrow raisers? People saying, wow, Randy, way to go.
Well, I typically call myself a jazz violinist, but on this particular record, I've tried to broaden outside of the jazz concept. I've written some songs with lyrics, and I've had other vocalists come in and sing these to me. I sing the title track, Soul of a Man, so I have not put myself out there as a jazz vocalist, but it is something I do in concert.
I traveled across this country. I traveled to the furthest land. I ain't found no one to tell me yet.
What is the soul of a man?
Well, I want somebody to tell me.
Why don't you tell me?
Answer if you can.
Answer if you can.
I want somebody to tell me.
Why don't you tell me?
Well, then what is the soul of a man?
Is there a biggest joy among all the functions that one finds, and here's a term I just coined, in the Sabin bag?
How do you like that? I like that.
Oh, the beanbag.
Yeah.
Like the game.
Yeah.
Ah,
that's
very
nice.
Good.
So a biggest joy among writing, performing, recording, experimenting, teaching.
Yeah, when I'm on stage, my eight-piece fiddlehead band with the triple fiddles and all these great musicians that I play with, surrounding myself with a whole stage full of great players, that's the biggest thrill. Making live music with, you know, amazing musicians on stage for an audience that appreciates what I do. That's the best.
Speaking of great musicians, Sue Orfield, you're going to be on stage with her on the 26th. And there's kind of a highlight. You're bringing some pupils along.
That's right. I'm tapped into the faculty and the student population here at McNally Smith College. And I'm bringing a master's degree guitar student, Kyle Baker. And I'm bringing a bachelor's degree guitar student, Dan Catton. A faculty member, Gary Rayner, on string bass, who also was on the Prairie Home Companion show for many years. So it's an all acoustic string show. It's all original music as well. Never done an all original show, so I've tapped into some of my catalog and some pieces that I've recorded but not performed live before, and also some brand new pieces as well. And Sue will be playing saxophone on about six tunes.
Sounds like fun. Randy Sabine, we're looking forward to having you in the neighborhood.
Hey, thanks, man. I'll see you next week.
Randy Sabine. It's as much fun to watch him play as it is to hear him play. It's like watching a kid in a sandbox. And I mean that. Not a video game. A sandbox. If you haven't tried it, you should. Catch Randy and friends with Sue Orfield next Thursday, the 26th, 7:30 p.m. at the Heide Center in Chippewa Falls. The website there is cvca.net, of course. Hey, Friday evening at Simply Done in Downsville, White Pine celebrates the spring equinox with an open mic of fiction, poetry, music, and comedy. It all begins at 6:30. Here's a message to Mackenzie Wagner, Dean Collenbach, and Debbie Brown. Couldn't do it without you, and we wouldn't do it without you out there, because there wouldn't be any point. So thanks for following Spectrum West whenever you can. You can grab pieces online at WPR.org anytime. Just click on shows. Next week, we'll have a tribute to the music of the Civil War and, of course, more. Always more on Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Thanks. See ya.